Dr. Shaw discusses vaccines with those who have opted out. Maine has one of the highest vaccination rates in the nation, but that statewide statistic doesn't really tell the whole story. The numbers vary widely by zip code. Some towns, including York, Hancock, and Kingfield, report a 99% vaccination rate. Other Maine towns, including Jonesboro, Porter, Sherman, and Hiram, report only about half of their residents as vaccinated. Even though vaccines are now widely available and free, many people have chosen not to get vaccinated for a variety of reasons. Are you one? If so, Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah wants to hear from you. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Dr. Shah returns to the show to talk with those who are skeptical of the public health guidelines from him and others. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by listeners and by Maine General Health, a comprehensive system for all your health care needs. Learn more at MaineGeneral.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we welcome the new year, and we welcome back Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. He joins me to answer your questions about COVID-19, but with a particular focus this time. Dr. Shah wants to hear from people who chose not to get the COVID vaccine. So if you are hesitant or skeptical about getting vaccinated, we hope that you will call in or email in. Share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call. Our number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can watch a live stream of today's program by going to Maine Public's YouTube channel or to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Shah, before though, we turn our focus to those who have chosen not to be vaccinated, why don't you give us a quick update? What is the latest information you're seeing about Maine's situation in terms of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and good morning. Happy New Year, everyone. It's great to be back on and great to have the opportunity to chat with folks today. To set the table, you know, we're now in the fourth calendar year of the pandemic, a pandemic that started gaining steam in 2019. And here we are, four calendar years later, contending with it and still making sure we can get our head around it. And that's really the backdrop against why I wanted to chat with folks today, because the vaccines remain our single most powerful and promising tool to get us out of the vaccine, out of the pandemic. Things in Maine right now are in a challenging state. Case counts and case numbers are among the highest that they've ever been at any point in the pandemic. Much of that is driven by the Omicron variant. Now, in absolute percentage terms, the Omicron variant is only accounting for, as of yet, not yet a majority of cases in Maine, but it's expanding at such a pace that it will not be long before Omicron is at least on equal footing as the Delta variant, if not having overtaken it entirely. And that is causing, unfortunately, an uptick in our hospitalization rates. After seeing a bit of a lull over the past 2 weeks, hospitalization rates are back on the increase again. As of this morning, 369 people in Maine were in the hospital with COVID-19. 113 of them were in the ICU and 54 of them were on a ventilator. Those numbers, we fear, will continue to go back upward. Omicron is not just putting strain on individuals and the healthcare system, it's also introducing more and more cracks into society. Vaccines are our surest way out of that, and Maine has made unbelievable progress when it comes to vaccines. You know, about a year ago today, there were 33,425 people who had gotten at least their first shot. Today, that number stands at 1,154,000 people. So a year later, we have vaccinated now almost 76% of the entire population of Maine, but we've got more to go. And that's really what I want to talk with folks about today. What are the questions that are on your mind? What are things that you are concerned about? And to the extent possible, what can we do to help provide answers?
Dr. Shah, let me ask you about people who are doing self-administered tests. I'm wondering, there's so much of that going on now, and so many people are getting positive results. Do the numbers that we're hearing about how many new COVID tests there are every day, are they even close to accurate? I mean, clearly people are not all telling you when they get a positive test result.
No, and so in any type of outbreak or pandemic, we always recognize that there is a fraction of the population that is infected, that doesn't get tested, or who utilizes a home or what's called a point of care test, where that result may not be transmitted to the state health department. That's the case in every pandemic or epidemic that's ever occurred. And it's a function that it's a phenomenon that exists in every state, every country, every jurisdiction around the globe. That's okay, because what we do is model out what the pandemic looks like based on what we know. We don't need to see every single case to have a sense of how the dynamics of the pandemic are unfolding. That is exactly what epidemiological modeling is based on. The other thing that's important, though, is first of all, anytime we're thinking about home tests, what we have to do is make a calculation about whether the data that we lose is more or less important than the convenience that we gain. And based on where we are in the pandemic right now, convenience is what matters. The ability to get tested before you go to an event, before your kid goes to school, that trumps being able to have the state health department report that. Now, we still get thousands of reports every single day, and that's what allows us to get visibility into what's going on. So that trade-off is fundamental anytime we're thinking about testing. The other thing is, what metrics at this point in the pandemic really truly tell us how the nature of the pandemic is unfolding? Not long ago, I had the opportunity to chat with my colleagues from the other states, other state health department directors, and we were all fairly universal in our view that at this stage of the pandemic, it's things like hospitalizations, ICU admissions, ventilator usage that really tell us about the nature and severity of the pandemic.
Dr. Shah, one of the reasons you're on the program today is you really want to speak to those who have not been vaccinated and those who are skeptical of a lot of the information that's coming from public health officials like yourself, like Dr. Fauci. And before we go to calls, I want to ask you a question that I've heard from people I know. And one of them is, as we talk about the Omicron variant, and we're learning that it seems to be less deadly, less serious than the Delta variant and the original COVID variant, that that people are saying, well, why not just get it? Why not just get it and have it done with? Why bother getting vaccinated? Why bother wearing a mask? Why not treat it like being a little kid and getting chicken pox? Just get it and get it done with.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that line of thought, Jennifer, is that when I was a kid, that was the approach when you mentioned chicken pox, right? If someone got chicken pox, the theory was, well, let's just expose kids and get it over with, until the vaccine came along. And once the vaccine for chicken pox came out in the 90s, that mode of going about working with your kids disappeared. Because why take the risk? Why take the risk of exposing your child to chicken pox when a quick, safe, effective vaccine eliminates the risk altogether? I would say the exact same thing with respect to COVID and Omicron. Although there are some early signs that Omicron may not be as severe as Delta, it still is relatively severe when you stack it up against even the earliest variants of the COVID-19 virus. And so, given that we have a vaccine that is effective, safe, free, why even take the risk? Even if you are in that small slice of people that needs to be admitted to the hospital, why take the risk, given that we're running out of hospital beds across the country? Even if you're even in that smaller group that needs an ICU bed or a ventilator, why take that risk, given that even in Maine, hospital beds, ICUs, and ventilators are under extreme pressure? Why put healthcare workers through the task of caring for you when they could be caring for somebody who's having a heart attack or something like that? So I hear where that comes from. But my view is, when we have such an effective vaccine at our disposal, why take that risk?
We'll go to Carol. Carol's calling from Jefferson. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Dr. Shaw, I have what's called chemical sensitivity, and I'm one of these people that probably was wearing a mask long before this happened. I'm going to buildings. Fragrance really bothers me, especially laundry detergent. And so I've been treated with chemical sensitivity, and my doctor says, you know, you better be careful with this, taking this injection. So what do you say about that?
Well, above all else, you know, I can't provide you with medical advice. You'd have to really talak to your doctor about this. But having spoken with infectious disease experts, allergists, immunologists across the country who care for people who are in your shoes, what they have found is that individuals who have the sensitivities that you noted can and have been successfully able to be vaccinated. Sometimes it's preferable for them to be vaccinated, say, in their doctor's office so that one of the staff can have watchful eyes on them. Or if you go to one of the larger scale sites, to make sure you flag that, to flag your condition for the providers there so they can, again, make sure that they're keeping good watch on you. One of the things that we know about the vaccine is that although reactions are incredibly rare, they have happened, and vaccination sites across the state are prepared for that. So whether you choose to get your vaccine in your doctor's office after having spoken with him or her, or at a larger scale site, the most important thing to do is, first of all, have that conversation with your doctor, discuss the fact that you'd like to get vaccinated, and then take appropriate steps to prepare for that.
Okay. And is it possible to get it outside? I mean, going into doctor's offices, again, there's a lot of laundry detergent out there, a lot of fragrance out there.
And Carol, what you're asking, is it possible to get the vaccination outdoors?
Yes.
That would be more of a question for your doctor's office or the vaccine provider. There's certainly no reason on its face why you can't, but that would be an individual conversation that would have to be worked out with the vaccine provider.
And Dr. Shaw, let me ask you this. Carol is calling from Jefferson, driving distance from the Augusta Vaccination Clinic. Do you think there they would be willing to step outdoors and give somebody a vaccination?
You know, it depends on what time of day. During the middle of the day, it's a possibility, but that site's been pretty busy. I think you're probably more likely to have success going to a doctor's office where they would be able to work one-on-one with the patient. The larger scale sites are really designed to get hundreds of people per hour vaccinated. I think a smaller site would be able to provide that one-on-one interaction. That seems like Carol might be a little better for you.
All right, Carol, good luck to you. And thank you so much for calling today. I'll go to a tweet here from Richard. If you still need a booster and still need to get tested and still need to wear a mask and still get hospitalized after being fully vaxxed, it's probably time you admit you've been conned.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most common sentiments that I hear, see, and that folks raise with respect to the vaccine. And so, Richard, I'm glad that you raised it. Let's start that conversation with the following. The vaccines are designed primarily, above all else, to keep people alive, to keep them off a ventilator, and to keep them out of the hospital. Indeed, when they were studied, those were the goals of the vaccine that the scientists studied. Can people still get COVID after they got the vaccine? It can happen. We'll talk about, though, and the main thing I want to focus on is the relative risk. Are you better off with the vaccine or without it? See, the thing is, and the thing that I think underlies Richard's tweet and so many like it, is that it assumes a world in which a medical technology must be either 100% effective or be deemed a failure. But that's not the world any of us live in. Imagine if you were to go to your doctor and have a really, really terrible cold or a really bad infection, and you were to say, you know, doctor, I'm not feeling great, and the doctor were to say, well, here's an antibiotic. I don't know anyone who would say, well, does it work 100% of the time? And if not, I don't want it. Imagine if we said that for cancer, right? If your spouse had cancer and you went to the doctor and said, doc, will this chemotherapy be 100% effective? effective, guarantee that the cancer will be cured and it won't come back? The answer is going to be no. I don't know a lot of people who would pick up their bags and turn around and walk out the door. We all intuitively understand that medicine is about reducing our relative risk. Even if it doesn't get us to zero risk, it still brings that risk down. That is the essence of what modern medicine is designed to do. So let's talk about how the vaccines stack up when it comes to reducing your relative risk. So nationwide, as of October, an unvaccinated person had a 5 times higher chance of testing positive for COVID-19 than an unvaccinated person. So right off the bat, the vaccines lower your risk of getting COVID itself by fivefold. That's pretty good. Well, let's not stop there. Let's take a look at something like hospitalization. Are you more or less safe with the vaccine when it comes from to a hospital perspective? And the answer is you're better off getting vaccinated. Also, the national data from the CDC found that the rate of getting hospitalized was 8 times higher in unvaccinated people compared with vaccinated ones. So an 8 times higher chance of getting hospitalized. But let's look at the ultimate endpoint, the one that we all are concerned about, which is your chance of dying. That's ultimately what these vaccines are designed to do. And there too, getting vaccinated lowers your risk of death 14-fold. There are not many things in modern medicine that lower your risk of death 14 times. Does it lower it infinitely to zero? No, it doesn't. But that is in keeping with what medicine does. It lowers your risk.
All right. We are speaking with Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. He is here to talk with those who have not been vaccinated or who listen to the guidance from public health officials and have serious questions about that. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or send an email, talk@mainepublic.org. If you send an email, please keep it brief. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling, with help from Woodford F&B in Portland, offering indoor and patio dining and takeout 5 days a week. Menu at woodfordfb.com.
You know you're watching something on Netflix or HBO when you hear their catchy intro sounds.
Sound is something that humans culturally, at least now, don't think a lot about, but it has this really powerful ability to prime your brain for what's coming.
I'm Kimberly Adams, Audio Logos, next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace, join us this evening at 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Have you subscribed to The 10? The 10 is Maine Public's weekly e-newsletter that takes a closer look at 10 exceptional, thought-provoking, and compelling stories. These stories are not necessarily from the week's headlines. In fact, most are stories that you may have missed from Maine Public, NPR, PBS, the BBC, and more. To sign up or to check out past issues of The 10, please visit mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Joining me today, Nirav Shah, Director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He is here to answer your questions about the pandemic. In particular, he wants questions from those who are skeptical about COVID vaccines. Share your comments via email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And a reminder, you can watch today's show on Maine Public's YouTube channel or Maine Calling's Facebook page. We'll go to Sacco and Ethan. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks. Happy New Year, and thanks for taking my call. Great to be back on with you guys. Dr. Shah, thank you. I hope that someday we can do more of a town hall type forum where the public can really get involved. The reason is that we on the right feel like we are, you guys get to cherry pick and play fast and loose with the data and stuff. And then when we do that, when we cherry pick and talk about things, we get called conspiracy theorists. So, but my question is, about antibody-dependent enhancement and leaky vaccines specifically. So with ADE, Fauci recently came out and said, I believe because he was backed into a corner, that vaccines can actually worsen the effect upon the people who are vaccinated. And then on leaky vaccines, spreading, that happens when when the vaccines are not perfect and they leak and they spread, they leak to the people who are unvaccinated and make and get them sick because they are an imperfect vaccine and they are leaking out of wherever they were shot into your arm and going to other organs, going and then spreading to other people and getting it lodged in different places. This is our concern, Dr. Shaw. This is what we're worried about. This is why I'll never get the vaccine. Even if they come pounding at my door, I will say, no, you will have to. I will not do it, Dr. Shaw, because I've lost trust with Big Pharma. They have become a criminal in our minds with all of the litigation and stuff in the past. And that is our line in the sand, Dr. Shaw. Thank you
so much. Ethan, I think at least three questions there, at least three points. And Dr. Shaw, why don't we start with the last one? And that's the distrust of Big Pharma. And I think that that is really a concern that's not just among those on the right. I mean, a lot of concern, especially as we are in the middle also of the opioid epidemic here in Maine, at least a death a day, sadly, in this state. I mean, a real crisis as well. And the pharmaceutical industry playing an incredibly large role in that.
Yep, Ethan, I'm glad that you called in, and I do want to address your concerns. We'll start with your concern that you express about the uneasy relationship. I take it that you believe that Big Pharma has created and the role that they've played in the development of these vaccines. I think the way that I look at this is that just as with any very, very large set of organizations, whether it's pharmaceutical companies or the government or governments, there are elements of them that can be good and elements of them that can be of concern. And I think it's right to point out that the pharmaceutical industry has had an uneven, if not downright concerning record when it comes to things like the opioid crisis. But if we confine our analysis to the work that the pharmaceutical company has done in this realm, that is to say, vaccinations. I don't have the same reservations or concerns. The manufacturers that have made vaccines that are available in the US, to say nothing of those that are available around the globe, are not routinely the same ones that are involved with, say, opioids, save for one. Johnson & Johnson was involved with both, but Moderna does not have a wing of their business that's involved in the opioid crisis. Novavax, et cetera. So I think this is a situation where we don't want to paint with too broad of a brush. There can be good as well as bad within any large organization, let alone a set of organizations. Now, Ethan, you raised two more technical scientific concerns about the vaccines. And I guess my first question, as others are listening to this, is that this is an example of where long-term data as well as vetted sources matter. Let's look at the data that we've seen on the vaccines. Ethan raises two concerns, that one, the vaccines might actually be making people with COVID worse off. The second is that they could be leaky in some manner and actually then pose a risk to others. If this were the first day of our vaccination effort or the first day of the clinical trials that were designed to study these vaccines, I would say that is a hypothesis that needs to be investigated. And indeed, safety data on these types of events were collected during the clinical trials, but it's not day one of the clinical trials, nor is it day one of vaccination efforts. As I mentioned at the top, the United States, to say nothing of the rest of the world, has been vaccinating folks for almost 13, 14 months now. And that's built on clinical trials that occurred over several months with tens of thousands of people. If the phenomena that Ethan described were of concern, we would have seen them manifest either in the clinical trials or in the various follow-up trials that have been done, as well as at the population level. We haven't seen that. Instead, what we've seen is the exact opposite. The vaccines performing exactly as we would hope for them to. Lowering the risk of hospitalization by eightfold, lowering the risk of infection, and most critically, lowering the risk of death. Are they 100%? No. Nothing in modern medicine ever has been, and don't believe anyone who tells you that they've got a cure that's 100%. What they have done is been spectacularly good at lowering that risk. Final note, Ethan, no one will be forcing anybody to get the vaccine. No one will be pounding on your door. We're here to talk and build trust, not to go by force.
All right, Ethan, thanks for your call. We'll move on to Berwick and Sean. Hi, Sean, go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, go ahead.
Thank you for having me on. I called because I am one of the non-vaccinated. I had COVID in the beginning of November, and it put me down for 17 straight days. It was horrible. And the reason that I had never gotten vaccinated to begin with was because initially I felt that it got politicized, and I felt that it was kind of rushed, and, you know, it didn't make me feel comfortable. So I avoided it. And then I started thinking, well, if it was pushed and it was rushed, I'm not worried about my short-term possibilities of getting sick. I'm wondering what's going to happen in 5 years from now, 7 years from now. This is in my body. It's floating around in there. And we don't have trials for 5 years from now, 7 years from now. We don't know what the long-term effects are. So, you know, initially after having been sick with COVID, as sick as I was, I was like, yes, I have to do this. I absolutely have to get it. But now I've kind of backtracked because it doesn't seem to protect against Delta or Omicron. And if that's the case, and I've already had it naturally, and I have some natural antibodies for it, what's the point of getting it now?
Yeah. Sean, let me just tell you right at the outset, I completely hear what you're saying, and I'm really glad you called, because this is exactly the kind of conversation I want to have, Sean. I really, really hear what you're saying, and let me say this at the outset. Let me ask you an honest question. I hear your point about the long-term data. What time horizon of data would you feel comfortable with? You know, right now we're at about a year and a half of data, coming up on 2 years of data with these vaccines. I get your point that that's not enough, but could I ask you, what would be the right timeline for you?
You know, that's a great question for me. I bounce around with that one all the time. And I don't have an honest answer for you. And I want to point out, by the way, I'm an independent. I am not Republican or Democrat. This is not political for me. I think that getting politicized is crap. I'm talking about the health of the vaccine. I don't know. I guess for me personally, you know, I don't know, maybe 4 years. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I'm just an average, ordinary guy. And I'm afraid. I'm afraid to get it. And I'm afraid of getting sick again, because I got to tell you, I think I might have ended up in the hospital had it not been for the inhalers that I use for asthma.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sean, I want to try. This is, again, this is the exact kind of discussion I wanted to have with folks today. So I want to make a couple of observations or give you a couple of pieces of data and then get your reaction to it. All right. Here's on this long-term side effect piece, which again, I totally get. There are two things that I'd ask you to keep in mind on this long-term piece. The first one is as follows. When we think about long-term side effects, we think about those a lot for drugs that fundamentally alter or disrupt our body, like chemotherapy, right? Cancer drugs. Those are designed to disrupt the way that that your body reproduces, so it destroys the cancer. Vaccines work completely differently. Vaccines are, you know, the vaccine is basically the difference between going into battle with a battle plan versus going into battle blind. The vaccines are just a battle plan that helps your body's immune system know thy enemy, in this case, the COVID vaccine, before it goes into battle. And the ingredients in these vaccines are remarkably basic. There is a solvent that's called PEG, or it's not a solvent, it's a compound that's used in just about everything in modern life. There is a couple of particles of RNA, and then there's some salt to keep the vaccines fresh. There's really nothing in the vaccine that is even postulated to stick around your body for more than a couple of days or weeks. So there's nothing in the vaccine that could even lead to those long-term side effects that I hear that you're worried about, unlike, say, a chemotherapy drug. So that's the first note, Sean. The other is that we're kind of in a world when it comes to drugs, particularly for COVID, that we don't have a lot of long-term data on a lot of the things that we use. So the other medications that are out there for COVID, things like monoclonal antibodies, you've probably heard about, to say nothing of these new pills from Pfizer and Merck, we don't have 4 years of data on those either. Now, I'm not saying you would be happy to take those if you were to get sick, but Sean, let me turn it back to you. What's your take on that? I mean, how do you respond when I tell you there's nothing in the vaccine that sticks around your body that long at all?
Well, and I appreciate it. I think more people need to hear. Like I said, I'm not against the vaccine, but I got to be honest, I'm kind of afraid of it, only because I saw what was happening in the media I'm trying to say this without causing a problem. Before the last election, there was a lot of talk of it, and there was this, you know, who's going to get credit for it, and that freaked me out because it wasn't, at that point, it wasn't about public health. It wasn't about, yeah, let's make you better. It was about, yeah, who's going to win the election because of it, and that made me nervous.
I hear that, Sean, and I'll tell you, I think the politicization of all things public health, but certainly the vaccines, has had a real impact. I mean, you know, we're talking right now, and you're telling me that the politics that were embedded in this caused and generated concerns on your end. I'm glad that you're with us, because it could have gone the other way with COVID, but I think I agree. There's a real cost to this. Now, I'd be remiss, Sean, and if I didn't say that, even though you've had COVID, thankfully you made it through to the other side. As you know, there's still a good reason to get the vaccine, because the new variant that we're dealing with seems to be a little bit more slippery. And having the vaccine on board, since you've already had COVID, provides pretty much the gold standard worth of protection. But I hear and understand the concerns that you're raising. I'm really glad that you called in.
Well, I one more thing I just want to mention, that, you know, I was told that I'll carry the antibodies for anywhere from 2 months to 6 months. I'm in an industry where I float around with the public a lot, and, you know, somebody sneezes, somebody coughs, I get very freaked out. I wear a mask when I can. Admittedly, I don't wear it as much as I should, because I guess I'm cocky because I had COVID, though I don't know if I had a variant. I don't know if I just had COVID, or if I had Delta, or if I had Omicron. All I know is that for 17 days, I was very, very ill. And then it took weeks to come out of it with some really strange side effects. But they seem to be going by now, and I'm more or less back to normal. I'm glad that you were able to talk to me, because maybe I will get the vaccine. I mean, you know, especially now that you've explained that it's not going to be a long-term thing, but it's scary. You have something put into your body and you're just not 100% what it is. I've never been one of those people that follows the crowd. You know, if it's my time and it's time for me to go, well, then I'm going to go. If I can avoid it, obviously, you know, I would like to do that, but not at the risk of getting sicker down the road. You know, if I'm, you know, 60 years old and suddenly I have heart condition because I got the vaccine, or I've got a liver problem or a kidney problem or something like that that was unforeseen years before.
Sean, I respect the fact that you've called in, and I respect the fact that you're thinking about this carefully and thoughtfully. The only thing I could ever ask anyone to do is to be mindful about their own health. and you're doing just that. And I applaud you for doing that. You know, here's what I'll tell you. If you were my buddy or my cousin or, you know, and you called me asking for my personal recommendation, given what you've shared with me, I wouldn't have any hesitation asking you, recommending that you get the vaccine. I recommended the vaccine to my own mother, and I would not do so unless I were 100% sure that it was worth doing.
Sean, I appreciate you calling in. I appreciate your honesty and your willingness to share your story, and so glad that you survived your bout with COVID. And Dr. Shaw, I know you appreciate his call as well. We do need to go to another break, and we have so many more calls coming in. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Lamy Wellahan Shoes, helping Maine students attend college in their home state through the annual Maine Difference Scholarship, more at lwshoes.com.
I'm Scott Tong. A political scientist has been poring over court documents to learn who the January 6th insurrectionists were and where they came from.
The counties that sent insurrectionists lost the most white population, specifically non-Hispanic white population.
And he's got some surprising findings next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now, coming up shortly from 12 noon until 2 o'clock after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio. There's a lot going on here in Maine all winter long: concerts and classes, lectures and literature, fairs and festivals. How can you connect to it all? Maine Public's community calendar. It's easy to find things to do. Search by type of event, date, or location. And if you represent an organization and want to let Mainers know about your event, it's easy to enter the details on our online form. Maine Public's community calendar, bringing the people of Maine together. Visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah joins us to address questions about vaccinations. If you're hesitant to get vaccinated against COVID-19, Dr. Shah wants to hear from you. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Let's see. We are going to go to Jessica calling from York. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I really want to thank Dr. Shaw for this dialogue. It's very helpful. Second of all, I don't want to deter anyone from listening. My family and I have been vaccinated and boosted. My concern is that I have friends and family that I love, that are intelligent, that I care for deeply, that are just really disillusioned with the CDC. They feel like the information is not accurate. My question to you is two-part. A, first of all, why do people feel that way? I don't understand. And B, where can we go for science that's considered fair and that is accurate and that is not something that would be considered politicized?
Yeah, Jessica, thank you. You know, let me start. Here's the reason I wanted to talk with folks today. We're in this world where if people trust you, then the science doesn't really matter. And if people don't trust you, then the science doesn't really matter. And so much of where we are with respect to COVID and asking folks to take steps that are useful for their health, the health of their communities, it comes down to trust. But trust isn't just something you can drop into a society or a conversation and expect it to be there in the manner that you think. Trust, in my book, happens one conversation at a time. It's something that my team and I have tried to do throughout the pandemic is have conversations. And we thought that where we are in the pandemic right now, this would be a good opportunity to talk with folks, to have that question and answer period, to try to gain trust. Part of it's about the science, but part of it is recognizing, as you noted, that a lot of folks have been disaffected by the US CDC, probably my own organization, the Maine CDC, and are, as a result, going to alternative directions. So my answer to your first question is why do folks feel disillusioned with the guidance and the analyses that federal health officials, and again, if I'm being honest, probably even state health officials put out. And I think some of it is because the guidance changes and they don't like, I get all of that, but fundamentally, I think it comes down to the fact that they don't trust it. And the only way we're gonna get around that is by moving beyond the notion that federal health officials are somehow disingenuous and at least getting toward the point where we can see that we might disagree on something and move to a better place. Where to go? Well, when it comes to vaccines and vaccinations, although the US CDC has changed its analysis and recommendation on things like masks, quarantine more recently, when it comes to vaccines and vaccinations, they've been remarkably consistent and steadfast. The vaccines work, they're effective. The CDC has put out strong data making that case. I previewed some of that earlier. And so when it comes to vaccines and what information you can equip your family members with, the US CDC remains, to me, a very good source of information. Jessica, the last thing I'll note though, is that when you're approaching those conversations with your family, and I encourage you to do that, recognizing that they can be fraught, but I think they are important as we're staring down a surge of Omicron cases. I would suggest that there's two things that motivate folks at this stage. Some of it is better science, knowing facts that they didn't know before. For example, in my exchange with Sean a couple minutes ago, sharing with Sean that most vaccine reactions occur in the first days, minutes, hours after a vaccine shot, not years and years later. That could be insightful. But the other thing to recognize is that a lot of folks, it's not that they may be on the fence anymore, it's that they're way off the fence and they have very well decided that a vaccine isn't for them. For a lot of folks, that position requires, again, multiple conversations and trust building before you might be able to bridge that common ground.
Jessica, thanks for your call. Dee on Facebook actually represents several that we're getting. She writes, how do you explain the tens of thousands of deaths and the hundreds of thousands of serious adverse reactions from the shots?
Great. Yeah, thanks for raising that. To answer that question, we have to talk about the surveillance system, the vaccine safety surveillance system that we have in the United States. For years now, there's been a federal system that goes by an acronym called VAERS, where any individual who can, whether it's a physician, a nurse, even a patient, who has had any sort of adverse reaction after a vaccine can file a report on it. Sometimes those adverse reactions can be pain in their arm. Sometimes it can even include and reflect things like death. This database is maintained by the US CDC, and scientists use it to understand whether there are emerging flags, concerns that require deeper investigation. Indeed, it's through those databases that we came to learn about some of the side effects, like things like myocarditis. These early warning systems do not tell us the difference between correlation and causation. And so when you hear folks say that tens of thousands of people have died after getting the vaccine, and hundreds of thousands of people have had adverse events. Well, here we have to get a little bit grim and morose. Unfortunately, given the hundreds of millions of people who have received the vaccine, indeed 1.1 million people in Maine alone, it's unfortunately the case that some of them, after getting the vaccine, will have a bad health event happen. Some of them will unfortunately pass away, not because of the vaccine, but rather after the vaccine. That does not suggest that the vaccines were the cause. To understand causation, we look at things like double-blinded randomized trials. That's why we do those studies, and that's why we keep them going even after the vaccines are approved, so we can keep studying their safety. And there, I want everyone to feel safe knowing that the vaccines have not been associated with an increase in death or disease. As I mentioned earlier, it's just the opposite.
We'll go to Lee, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. My daughter has two kids, a girl who's 8, a boy who's 10. And I also have a neighbor who's got a girl who's 7 and a boy who's 4, who are hesitating to get their kids vaccinated because they have read that there are problems down the road with menstrual periods with the girls, and they're just concerned about that and any reproductive issues and I've never read any of this stuff, and I don't know where she's coming from on it and where she's read it, but she said she's read it in good sources. Can you respond to that? Because I'd really like to get these kids vaccinated.
I sure can, Lee. I'm glad that you called in, because I've seen this question come up quite a bit, again, on social media predominantly. And I'm glad you raise it, because I think there's a lot of parents who have this concern. It's related to the concern that Sean noted earlier about the future of the vaccines and are they really safe in the long term. Many parents have written into us asking particularly about for their girls, whether there would be any effects on their menstrual period or on reproductive health in general. Let me zero in on this really quickly. I'm really glad you raised it. The first is, let's acknowledge that these parents are concerned, and that's where this question comes from. They're concerned in a manner that we ask every single parent to be. Before you put anything in your kid's body, you should make sure that it's safe. And that's why we're talking today. The vaccines, based on everything we've seen and researched and found, they do not have any impact on fertility. Indeed, the way that they work, going back to the point I made with Sean, is really what they do is set out a battle plan for your body's immune system so that if your body encounters the virus again, it's ready to fight it. That's preferable than going into battle with no plan whatsoever, which is really what you're asking your body to do if you're unvaccinated. The vaccines have been extensively studied, particularly the Pfizer one, which these young children would be eligible for. The vaccines have been extensively studied in kids, and they are continuing to be studied in kids even younger than the kids that you mentioned, Lee. And among the things that they're studied for is their safety. Do they have the side effects that you mentioned, even in the kids that are at this age or kids that are beyond this age period? The vaccine trials have been ongoing for quite some time now, to say nothing of the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of kids now who have received them. Based on everything we've seen, we haven't seen this risk come up. Lee, this also has to be balanced with right now the concerns around COVID, the concerns around the fact that COVID is increasingly affecting young kids. More kids across the country are landing in the hospital. One of the fundamental trade-offs, or not trade-offs, but one of the fundamental questions that you have to ask when you're thinking about any drug, any vaccine, any medical procedure or device, is it worth it right now? Are the risks of the future more concerning than the risks of the present? And right now, with Omicron coming our way, already here, causing more cases, with kids being more hospitalized because Omicron is more transmissible, the risk of the concern today, in my mind, outweighs those hypothetical concerns that have been voiced. I'm not aware of a single peer-reviewed publication in a reputable medical journal written by a reputable physician or scientist that has affirmed the concerns that you've noted. Almost the only place I've seen it noted is on the dark corners of Facebook and Twitter. And believe me, those corners are very dark.
Lee, thanks for your call. I'm going to move on to Owl's Head and Ryan. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking the time, Nirav. I have basically my question or hesitation is that COVID as a virus to me doesn't present a great enough risk to justify vaccination that poses its own set of risks. So in looking at the most current data from the New York Times, it looks like all time the total deaths attributed to COVID at this time are 1,531, and that's for the state of Maine. And as a percentage of the population, that's extremely, extremely low. So I, in a sense, I deny really the danger of this virus, and therefore I don't see a risk-benefit analysis that the vaccine presents any good for us compared to the danger that COVID presents.
Ryan, if I could ask, you're right insofar as that there have been about 1,100 deaths, over 800,000 deaths in the United States. Now, to infectious disease experts and epidemiologists, that's actually a pretty risky thing. If we were seeing any other type of phenomenon cause those death rates every single week, year, month, we'd be alarmed, as Jennifer noted in connection with, say, the opioid crisis. We would be alarmed. So right off the bat, I think you and I have a different view of what constitutes a risk. But I'm not here to debate with you. I want to try to answer your questions. And here's my question, Ryan, why do you believe that you would not be among those who would succumb to some of the bad outcomes?
For the same reason that I don't believe that I would win the lottery.
Which is that it's statistically unlikely?
100%. So I can say that it is statistically unlikely and a near probability zero event that COVID would kill me. And I could say the same thing for you as well.
My thought there, Ryan, is that virtually every single person in the vaccination era who has died of COVID, I fear, had the same approach. When you take a look at the factors that lead to bad outcomes from COVID, the list of pre-existing medical conditions is quite long. They're not necessarily distinct from other infectious diseases. That's just a function of infectious diseases. I hear your view that statistically it's unlikely, but what about others in your community? Unless you truly do not interact with others, grandparents, parents, others who are vulnerable, even if you weren't doing it for yourself, what about others in your community who may be at risk from catching COVID and having one of those bad outcomes, even if you yourself were okay?
Sure. No, that makes sense. And you did bring up the 800,000 deaths in the U.S. Now, 800,000 deaths out of the 330 million population size of the U.S., a death is still a statistical anomaly, right? Like, if we're talking statistics, that's still statistically insignificant. So the fact that I may run into somebody who has a greater predisposition for being at risk, that would actually be a very highly improbable event for me to run into one of those individuals. Would you
agree?
Okay,
Ryan, I'm going to let Dr. Shaw, I'm going to give him 10 seconds to wrap it up.
No, I wouldn't agree. If it were statistically improbable, we would not have had 800,000 plus deaths in the United States. The fact is that a lot of people can and do get affected by COVID. And even those who are seemingly, by their own thought, healthy, have unfortunately died.
Ryan, thanks for your call. And Dr. Shaw, thank you so much for spending an hour with us here today. Nirav Shaw, Director of Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. We had help from Nick Godfrey and Nick Woodward. Maine Calling was produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And this show will be re-aired tonight at 7. Tomorrow on the program, we will have the latest news and updates on Maine's ski industry. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.